Okay, over to you.
Okay. Well, hello, friends. Sorry about all the confusion. We got our recording going now. And as I said before, if I may have to just suddenly stop and mute myself because I have this cough, but I'd really rather go ahead with the webinar. I had to cancel last Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and I just don't want to cancel any more webinars. So we'll just forge ahead and see how it works out. So we're at number 77. And as you all know, this webinar is available on Makara.us under the subheading Mori Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, as shown here. All episodes of this, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald, oops, and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of moriafederation.com. Okay. This month in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott is back in Colombo, Sri Lanka, giving a lecture on the Buddhist precepts called Panchasila to a group of, ready for this, Buddhist lepers on a nearby isolated island. So, he did this with a certain risk to his own self, but he felt that it was worth it to make the effort to teach this group of Buddhist lepers. So, could we get a reader for the first of two pages here?
I'll start the first page.
Okay.
Among the lectures delivered in and about Colombo this time was one to the lepers, who had sent a very urgent request to me to visit them and give them the Panchasila and a religious discourse as to their meaning. This unhappy class are segregated at Colombo on a grassy, palm-embellished islet a few miles from town, where government has commodious buildings for their occupancy and medical treatment. They themselves have built a little preaching hall in which Buddhist religious emblems are kept and are overjoyed when they can get any Buddhist to come and teach them something about their religion. It is a frightful experience, however, to face such an audience and see the distortions and mutilations caused by the human body by this pest of mankind.
Thank you, BL. And next up.
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. I was just wondering what year that last one was. I guess that was before penicillin,
Well, this whole Old Diary Leaves takes place in the 80s. At least the volume we're in now is 84 and 1885. So yeah, no penicillin, nothing like
Okay,
that.
thank you. Okay, I had to shut my eyes a moment and brace myself up to the revolting sights before me before beginning the Sila ceremony with the solemnly resounding Pali words of the opening sentence. Then again, some extra interest was given to the occasion by the thought that perhaps one might get infected with the microbes of the awful disease, as Father Damien had and others. Of course, it was but a remote chance at best, yet it was one, just as it depends on one's karma whether the bullet of Private X of the enemy's regiment in front of one's position shall find its billet in one's body or elsewhere. And until our doctors know more of the cause and cure of leprosy, such precautionary reflections are excusable. Well, the afflicted ones at the leper island were very grateful for the visit and forgot the mutilations of their hands and their necessarily unlovely appearance when they joined their palms together in front of their foreheads and sent after me towards the flower-festooned bars their mournful cry of Sadhu, Sadhu.
Thank you, Yvonne. Yeah, you know, Colonel Olcott was a kind of Buddhist rock star, and all through India. And, you know, for him to make the effort, take the time, and put himself at risk to go to this colony, I thought was quite moving, you know. Okay, so last month we continued with verse 5, where we learned about the asuras. That means without form, who, claiming the right of free agency and independent judgment, quote, refuse to create physical man, only to become the direct saviors and the creators of divine man. Saviors because by refusing to incarnate, they were able to stay on the higher planes where they could work to form humanity's higher sheaths. We then took a look at the Codex Nazareus, the scripture of the Nazarenes, which HPB calls the real mystic Christians of John the Baptist and the initiates of Christos. From this codex, we learned the Gnostic story of creation, which we're kind of in the middle of that in HPB's text, which in marked contrast to Christian doctrine does not vilify the formless class of Mahadevas, and who, unlike in the Christian story, sees them as unable rather than unwilling to create mental, astral, and physical plane forms. Thus, in this teaching, dispelling the really absurd myth of warring groups of angels. So, just as a review, the main characters in the Gnostic creation story are Lord Pharaoh, the first logos, Manu, the Christ-like second logos, Abatur, the third logos, Fetahil, an emanation from Abatur for the sole purpose of forming the earth, really. Bahak Zivo, the father of the genie, quote unquote, Spiritus, who is called on when Fetahil is unable to create the lower forms, and Spiritus's son, the blind and frantic Karabtanos, who under Spiritus's guidance creates the archons or planetary elementals. But as a result of this creation, the lower regions are cut off from the upper eons. One of the hallmarks of any esoteric creation story is a recognition of each of the stages from pure formless deity, note the hand gestures as we descend through these, to the light-bearing second aspect, also shown here, to the builders, the Devic realms of the third aspect, also connected with Brahma. All three of these aspects are connected with Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. And in this one, note the downward pointing open palms from which emanates Fetahil, shown in the center, or represented, I should say, by this center grouping. Who, like the fourth ray Lord, stands as intermediary between the higher and lower three. In other Gnostic sects, the position of Fetahil was taken by Yaldabaoth, whose symbol was a lion-headed serpent. Cosmically speaking, this is the visible sun, and the higher logoi, Lord Pharaoh and Manu would then be the central spiritual sun and the heart of the sun, cosmically speaking. But it's not until Spiritus, who is a personification of the form aspect, is called upon that a further descent into matter becomes possible. Because without the form aspect, matter, inhabited matter, forms cannot be created. So to make this descent, she awakens Karabthanos, the blind spirit of matter. So the creation story then continues. Seeing this, Fetahil extends his hand downward towards the abyss of matter and says, "Let the earth exist just as the abode of the powers has existed." Dipping his hand in the chaos, which he condenses, he creates our planet. Because the lower eons have been cut off from the source of spirit, seven quote-unquote badly disposed principles emerged. We see them listed here in the second circle as deceit, injustice, wrath, pride, lust, greed, and inconstancy. And this is where we were last time when we stopped, so we'll continue, you know, with the dialogue. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, and Parker, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. And in order to counteract the influence of the seven badly disposed principles, the progeny of Spiritus, Kabarzio, the mighty lord of splendor, produces seven other lives, the cardinal virtues, who shine in their own form and light from on high, and thus reestablish the balance between good and evil, light and darkness. Here one finds a repetition of the early allegorical dual systems as the Zoroastrian, and detects a germ of the dogmatic and dualistic religions of the future, a germ which has grown into such a luxuriant tree in ecclesiastical Christianity. It is already the outline of the two supremes, God and Satan. But in the stanzas, no such idea exists.
Thank you, Anne. So first, and in order to counteract the influence of the seven quote-unquote badly disposed principles, the progeny of Spiritus, Kabarzio, the mighty lord of splendor, produces seven other lives, the cardinal virtues, who shine in their own form and light from on high, and thus reestablish the balance between good and evil, light and darkness. So as we've learned, Spiritus is the feminine aspect responsible for creation of the lower quaternary. The supposed progeny of Spiritus are the seven badly disposed principles, called by Christians the seven deadly sins. But neither the cardinal sins nor the cardinal virtues appear anywhere in the Gnostic teachings, especially in the Codex Nazareus. In fact, these virtues and sins were added by the church fathers during the 4th century AD. So the idea that Lord Pharaoh emanated the seven virtues to offset the seven sins is a later Christian idea, not a Gnostic one. What Lord Pharaoh or Kabarzio actually created were the seven eons, which were later again by the church fathers associated with the seven cardinal virtues, as shown here, probably as part of the church's attempt to co-opt Gnosticism. We're not going to go through this because, to my mind, this list is completely exoteric and has nothing to do with original Gnosticism. Any thoughts or questions so far? Okay. Next, here one finds a repetition of the early allegorical dual systems, as for example, the Zoroastrian, and detects a germ of the dogmatic and dualistic religions of the future, a germ which has grown into such a luxuriant tree in ecclesiastical Christianity. It is already the outline of the two supremes, God and Satan, but in the stanzas, no such idea exists. The duality represented by both, you know, she quotes the Zoroastrian, and the Zoroastrian duality was Ahura Mazda and Angra Mainiyu, that's it, Angra Mainiyu. And by the higher and lower eons of Gnosticism. These are simply the duality of spirit and matter. Note the lack of any pictorial elements marking Angra Mainiyu, he's over here on the right, as evil in this frieze. They both grasp the same circle, thus representing the first fundamental duality. The error embraced by Christian dogma comes to the idea that matter, the feminine principle, is inherently evil. You know, poor, you know, oh, miserable sinner am I, kind of a thing. What began as a story of the relationship between spirit and matter using allegorical characters representing good and evil deteriorated into the polarity of a literal belief in an anthropomorphic God and Satan as ultimate incarnations of good and evil. Contrary to this moral orientation, most of the ancient doctors, as well as theosophists, recognized that, as HPP states, spirit is but matter at its highest level. Let me say that again. Spirit is but matter at its highest level of manifestation, and matter is but spirit at its lowest. And actually, pure spirit doesn't exist in the manifested universe. It's all relative, because the very term manifested requires a form-based merging of spirit and matter. I see a hand.
Go ahead, please, Yvonne.
This is one of these questions where, you know, that's my early Catholic upbringing. So I just heard you say there is no original sin and we really don't need to be baptized?
Oh, it depends on what you make of the process of...
That's 21 years of Catholic school. That's where that comes from.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think baptism can be an incredibly meaningful experience. It can be a symbol for a new start. You know, ultimately the second birth is soul infusion, right? That's what it represents. You know, you're literally baptized in the Holy Spirit. And here we have an expert, Martha Gallahue.
Please go ahead, Martha.
That the statements in the actual baptism require that one accept the inherent evil from original sin. So the literal baptism, the way it's written, requires an affirmation of the inherent evil. So my daughter, who was confirmed, read that and refused to have her children baptized as a result. It was an independent decision, but she just read the writing and said, no way is this, this cannot be possible. I cannot do this.
Yeah, you see the long arm of this mistake that the Christian fathers promulgated from way back, you know, which is that that negative pole, which is, it's just substance, it's just matter, it's form, right, was turned into evil, right? Like, you know, this make-believe devil figure here. And therefore, you have to recognize, you have to make that affirmation in order to be baptized. Now, you know, a theosophist could easily get around that by just saying, I recognize that I am spirit and form. you know. But you would have to change the words. And if you have the perspective, then, you know, it becomes questionable as to whether a Christian baptism would actually be that meaningful for you, you know. But I, you know, I don't like to poo-poo these types of symbolic events, you know, these ritual events, because I think people make huge changes as a result of the process. You know, they really do make a new start with it. But philosophically, well, you know, we've gone over this idea of what it means philosophically. Other hands?
Yes. Martha, your hand is up again, or because I lowered it a minute ago.
I only just wanted to add that is not the way Protestant baptisms read.
Oh.
That's just point of information.
That's just Catholic. Oh, just the Catholics have that idea, huh, of recognizing inherent sin or evil or, Okay, good to know. Go ahead.
We have a couple of more. Ariana, go ahead. Ariana, sorry.
That's okay. Thank you so much. I can't help but have a strong reaction to this on a number of levels, because you can see once you condemn people for something that happened in the past, there's no way of correcting for it. And so it creates, you know, both psychological weakness, but also an opening for diseases of all kinds, you know, not only mental health issues, but physical disease. But what I wanted to say, and I might have mentioned it before, is the baptism is one of the most profound events in the Bible. It's a symbolic moment, symbolic of the Christ coming down into Jesus during the last 3 years of his teaching, in right. which, you know, the Christ, people call it the Christ consciousness, or I believe that Maitreya was there, and they were both inhabiting Jesus's body and teaching together in full consciousness from Jesus. And I remember, just to share a personal story, I mean, these stories and these experiences can be life-changing. I didn't grow up with these rituals, but when I was in my 20s, I took communion in Notre Dame in Paris, and it was so extraordinary for me just to have that experience. And I don't take it lightly I don't want to leave it as a dead ritual or the interpretation of doctrine that we're meant to outgrow, that doesn't really suit humanity where it is now. So I have to protest, because it's so heavy.
Yeah. Well, you make two good points. You know, first of all, there really is a true baptism. It's has very much connected with the second initiation. Jesus was recapitulating his second initiation with John the Baptist in the river there, Jordan. The waters of heaven, you know, it's interesting. Paul Simon just came out with a new album called Seven Psalms, and one of them is The Waters of Heaven. And he talks about this very thing, bathe yourself in the holy waters of heaven. And it just came right to me when we were during this discussion, because it's the idea of the purification, the true purification of the astral at an astral level that happens at the second initiation. It's what I would dare say most of us are preparing for. I'm not saying we're preparing for the second initiation, but we're in the process of purifying our astral vehicles for whatever future spiritual recognition will take place as a result. And I think that's the real meaning behind the baptism. And, you know, just because there's some dogmatic errors it doesn't mean that the ritual can't be profoundly meaningful. And I would say the exact same thing is true with the you know, with the idea of the Eucharist. So you know, in fact, the Gnostics had their own versions of the Eucharist. They were interpreted differently, but you know, the actual ritual itself can be a profound experience. So I'm right with you, Ariane, that you don't, you know, intellectually dismiss these ritualistic forms because you think you have you understand, you know, what's really going on. I think that's a very dangerous road to take, and you know, you have to have respect for these things. Nonetheless, you know, we are trying to reveal the truth here in these teachings. So I see other hands.
Yes. Go ahead, please, Greg.
I might be a little bit behind on the discussion here, but in the last section where we're talking about the seven deadly sins or the seven the broken pieces of what, however they were saying, I found it really interesting. As soon as I tuned in, I saw, oh my gosh. So this is similar too, because the baptism is an expression of the purification of the lower body, that's the way I would imagine it too, or envision it, or identify the experiences behind it. But I was thinking that right now I'm working a big synthetic paper on the qualities of energy itself and how energy is essentially, it's the conservation of energy, which is a physical law that we've uncovered, but it also fits directly into what you were just in the last section when you were speaking that, and then God said, provide the energy for, or to, so energy becomes form, that before the energy couldn't be present because it was locked in that focus, and then it took the will of the spirit or the spiritus to come in and say, to open the form for more form, in that qualification of conservation of energy, in a sense. I felt like, because they even used, I think I even heard the word energy in terms of that initial motivation, that abstract whatever had to create a new form, and to, in a sense, pull from Full Hat the structure to create the new form, so that the seven sins or whatever can be reintegrated or remanifested into the world.
Yeah, the key is in Fohat. You know, this is Fohat is the method by which spirit and matter are bound together. So it, you could say, is a fundamental universal principle, and it also is the means by which we release ourselves from the bonds of matter, using Fohat on the upward spiral. And you know, you could see that the virtues, especially, are a very exoteric way of understanding this upward progression, this upward process. You know, you take on these qualities in order to become more spiritual, you know, and you know, that's great for people who don't want to pursue this any further than that, because it's much more easily understood than the philosophic underpinnings. Anyway, let's go ahead. Could we get a reader for the next section, please?
Sure. Greg, can you read that for us, please?
Okay. Most of the Western Christian Kabbalists, preeminently Eliphas Levi, in the desire to reconcile the occult sciences with church dogmas, did their best to make of the astral light only and preeminently the pleroma of early church fathers, the abode of the hosts of the fallen angels, of the archons, and the powers. But the astral light, while only the lower aspect of the absolute, is yet dual. It is the anima mundi and ought never to be viewed otherwise except for Kabbalistic purposes. The difference which exists between its light and its living fire ought to be ever present in the mind of the seer and the psychic. The higher aspect without which only creatures of matter from that astral light can be produced is this living fire, and it is the seventh principle.
Thank you, Greg. Okay, first up, most of the Western Christian Kabbalists, preeminently Eliphas, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, Levi, in their desire to reconcile the occult sciences with church dogmas, did their best to make the astral light only and preeminently the pleroma of early Christian fathers, the abode of the hosts of the fallen angels, of the archons and powers. So let's start by getting acquainted with the terms and names in this passage. The Western Christian Kabbalists were scholars and mystics who adapted the Jewish Kabbalah, a form of esoteric Jewish mysticism, to their own Christian worldview. They emerged during the Renaissance amidst a revival of interest in occult knowledge and influenced the development of Western esotericism, such as Hermeticism and Rosicrucianism. One of the later incarnations of this movement was Eliphas Levi, a French esotericist and writer, author of over 20 books on magic, the Kabbalah, alchemical studies, and occultism. Contrary to what HPB here suggests, Levi did recognize that the astral light included the Akasha, and thus the five elements of the seven planets, the 12 signs, and the septenary of planes. In short, the pleroma of all cosmic physical plane existence, not just what D.K. Theosophists call the astral plane, or the early church fathers called the abode of the host of the fallen angels. So I didn't find any evidence that he was trying to fit his doctrine or his writings in such a way that they were in alignment with the church fathers. We have a similar example of this difference in understanding in the term archons, which in Gnosticism simply means, here again, that difference between matter and evil, simply means builders of the physical universe. But in Christianity, are seen as demonic, evil rulers of the realm of darkness. Next. But the astral light, well, only the lower aspect of the absolute, is yet dual. It is the anima mundi and ought never to be viewed otherwise except for Kabbalistic purposes. Okay, Theosophical Glossary defines anima mundi as, quote, the creative third logos in its female aspect and as, quote, the seven-skinned mother. It is thus Isis and Mula Prakriti, the substantive aspect of every plane of the cosmic physical plane, in contradistinction to the spirit aspect or the informing lives that use this primordial substance to form their vehicles. The lower regions of the anima mundi are the spiritus of the Gnostics, though it's just about impossible to tell exactly where her influence picks up. But from what I've been able to discern, this feminine being, Gnostic being called Spiritus, does not include the higher regions of the cosmic physical plane, as does, for instance, Isis. Next, the difference which exists between its light and its living fire ought to be ever present in the mind of the seer and the psychic. So the light of matter, because, you know, at its highest level, matter is light. The Mula Prakriti is called the shining sea, right? But nonetheless, this is not to be confused with the living fire of spirit. Finally, the higher aspect, without which only creatures of matter from that astral light can be produced, is this living fire, and it is the seventh principle. In HBB era theosophy, the seventh principle is Atma, or pure spirit, which alone is capable of bestowing the living fire. It's the source of this spirit aspect for all form. It's the source of the indwelling jiva. Creatures of matter from the astral light are called in other places chahayas or shells, and are devoid of soul. This part of their elemental selves does not include the soul aspect. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
It is said in Isis Unveiled, in a complete description of it, quote, "The astral light or anima mundi is dual and bisexual. The ideal male part of it is purely divine and spiritual. It is the wisdom, it is spirit or purusha. While the female portion, the spiritus of the Nazarenes, is tainted, in one sense, with matter, is indeed matter, and therefore is evil already. It is the life principle of every living creature, and furnishes the astral soul, the fluidic perisprit, to men, animals, fowls of the air, and everything living. Animals have only the latent germ of the highest immortal soul in them. This latter will develop only after a series of countless evolutions, the doctrine of which evolution is contained in the Kabbalistic axiom. A stone becomes a plant a beast a man a spirit, and the spirit a god." Unquote.
Thank you, Vivian. Okay, I think this is, even though I just checked the text, it is perisprit. I think it's supposed to be perispirit, with an I in there. So, okay, first up, it is said in Isis Unveiled and a complete description of it, the astral light or anima mundi is dual and bisexual. The ideal male part of it is purely divine and spiritual. It is the wisdom, it is spirit or purusha. While the female portion, the spiritus of the Nazarenes, is tainted, in one sense, with matter, is indeed matter, and therefore is evil already. So there are no stated boundaries of the astral light in first generation theosophy. Rather, it is described as the lower emanations of Akasha, existing in the lower regions of the anima mundi, and as that which animates all beings, which is why it is also called the world soul. More specifically, the astral light is composed of those regions that are, quote unquote, tainted by human will, thought, and emotions. Next, It is the life principle of every living creature and furnishes the astral soul, the fluidic peri-spirit, to men, animals, fowls of the air, and everything living. So the astral soul or astral personal ego in HPB theosophy is kama manasic, as shown here. Peri-spirit means that which surrounds or embodies the spirit aspect. Next. Animals have only the latent germ of the highest immortal soul in them. This latter will develop only after a series of countless evolutions. So the highest immortal soul is Atman, the monad in DK theosophy, which all living creatures have. But as we learned a few webinars back, the essence called monas only begins to form individual monads, that's an oxymoron, by the way, late in a jiva's passage through the animal kingdom, marked here by the blue circle. So all sentient beings in these early stages coming in through the elemental kingdoms at the central point of the mineral kingdom and then moving towards the plant kingdom. During all of that period, the monad is an overshadowing force that is not individualized for each specific entified incarnated being. You know, said simply, a rutabagas doesn't have a monad. It's overshadowed by monas. That's a Platonic term that means the influence of the monadic realm. But late in the animal kingdom, there's a kind of a precipitation, it's described as, of this monas into a monad for each individual. And then by the time you enter the human kingdom, then you have an individual monad. Okay. Okay, and finally, the doctrine of which evolution is contained in the Kabbalistic axiom, a stone becomes a plant a beast a man a spirit, and the spirit a god. So the kingdoms of nature that this Kabbalistic axiom represents, also this chart, is one of the bedrock tenets of theosophy. I'm not sure why HPB makes note of page 301, which marks the beginning of section 2 of this volume. Maybe in another version of the secret doctrine, it's representative of something, but I couldn't find anything. Anyway, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Scott, can you read that for us, please? Oh, before you start, Scott, I just wanted to say that a little while back when you were talking about evil, Greg said evil spelled backwards is live.
Okay. Francis, you couldn't find that last quote in Secret Doctrine because it's not there. It's in Isis.
Oh, that's my mistake. Yeah, let me look here. Oh, sure. She doesn't say Isis, but that's where it is. Okay. Good catch. Do you have it before you?
I can get it in just a second.
Okay, yeah. Why don't you go ahead and read and then we'll take a look at that. Ha, okay. I didn't even think of that. Did she say earlier that this is
very possible? Way at the top. Top of the page.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, thanks for that.
Okay. The seven principles of the Eastern initiates had not been explained when Isis was written, but only the three Kabbalistic faces of the semi-exoteric Kabbalah. The numbers, they are found, however, in the Chaldean Book of Numbers. But these contain the description of the mystic natures of the first group of Dayan Tohants in the Regimen Ignis, the region and rule or government of fire, which group is divided into three classes, synthesized by the first, which makes four, or the Tetractus. See the comments. If one studies the comments attentively, he will find the same progression in the angelic natures, that is, from the passive down to the active. The last of these beings being as near to the Ahamkara element, the region or plane where egoship or the feeling of I am-ness is beginning to be defined, as the first ones are near to the undifferentiated essence. The former are arupa incorporeal, the latter rupa corporeal.
Okay, thank you. So first up, the seven principles of the Eastern initiates had not been explained when Isis was written, but only the three Kabbalistic faces of the semi-exoteric Kabbalah. Lot in that footnote reads, they are found, however, in the Chaldean Book of Numbers. The they is probably referencing the seven principles. You remember this chart presented some months ago. The left-hand column shows the seven principles of the Eastern initiates that we're here told had not yet been introduced when Isis Unveiled was written. A Kabbalistic face called a partzuf, P-A-R-T-Z-U-F, a partzuf in the Kabbalah, is the divine persona or quality of a Sephiroth of the Tree of Life. The three highest partzufim are described here. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Yes. Okay, so we're looking at the three top circles in the Kabbalah. The first one, Kether Crown, Arich Anpin, long face, extending patience, the source of divine compassion and the inner dimension of Keter, the highest Sephira or emanation. Then we move to two on the right, Abba, Father, the illumination of wisdom and insight, the Partsuf of Chokhmah, the second Sephira. And then we go over to the left, Ima, mother, understanding and intelligence, the partsuf of Bina, the third Sephira. This is from hermetic.com.
Thank you, Martha. I wonder if the band ABBA knew. Okay, yeah, so it's interesting. This gives a new dimension on the Tree of Life, right? Which is that there's a qualitative aspect. It's almost as though the Sephiroth is the form aspect. And then you have this indwelling qualitative aspect as described here. The two are often brought together in a description. Okay, next up, but these Kabbalistic faces contain the description of the mystic nature of the first group of the Dayan Tohants in the Regimen Ignis, the region and rule or government of fire, which group is divided into three classes synthesized by the first. So HPP here correlates the Dayanis with the highest triad of Sephira. Within the cosmic physical plane, the region of fire is Atma Buddhi Manas. But fire is a relative term, akin to the term realm of spirit, quote unquote. The true regimen ignis is, in relation to our solar system, is on cosmic mental levels. Hey, Scott, did you find anything on 301 that would be relevant?
Not really. He's introducing living fire and then goes on to add this footnote to it. It goes off in a similar direction, but into first round theosophy. So right. I think.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. Okay, next. Which group is divided into three classes, synthesized by the first, which makes four, or the tetractus? So we've looked at the tetractus many times in past webinars. It represents three levels. You can see that I've taken the highest three Sephiroth and put them in here. But it's also the sum total. So it represents three levels with the sum total, which is also a function of Kether, representing the fourth. This is a profound figure revered by the Platonists, which holds within it the mathematical and symbolic matrix of creation. All existence issues from Kether and is therefore one with its in essence. At the end of a cycle, all return into Kether. 1 and 10 are numerologically the same, since 1 plus 0 equals 1. Thus, the 1 becomes the 10, the apex Kether becomes the tetractus. Then at the end of a cycle, Kether re-becomes the 1. Referencing Kether, here is one of the cited comments from stanza 7, alongside a description of the highest manifest hierarchy in our solar system, which HPB's quote further describes. I see as real strong correlation between these two. Could we get a reader just to read this section, starting with Parashakti, and then this paragraph on the right, please?
Okay, hold on just 1 second. Greg says, are we also talking tetrahedron in sacred geometries?
Well, yeah, certainly, you know, the tetractus is part of the lexicon of sacred geometry. But each of these figures, dodecahedron, in my mind is the most sacred and was considered also to be the most sacred by the Platonists. So you have to look at them individually, which I did, by the way, in my sacred geometry series. You can explore that if you want. It's a 25 webinar series. Okay, reader, please.
Ariane, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Energy types from seven constellations. Parashakti, supreme energy. The first aspect of the sixth type of cosmic electricity. Notice correlation to numbers in the names column. EA39 expresses the mental vibration of the solar logos. EA40. The highest group is composed of the divine flames, so-called, also spoken of as the fiery lions and the lions of life, whose esotericism is securely hidden in the zodiacal sign of Leo. It is the nucleus of the superior divine world. They are the formless, fiery breath, identical in one aspect with the upper Sephirothal triad, which is placed by the Kabbalists in the archetypal world. Secret Doctrine 1 is page 213.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, so you can see a lot of correlations in this paragraph from the Secret Doctrine. You know, normally when we go for information about the hierarchies, it is in either a treatise on cosmic fire or esoteric astrology. Most of the references are, but here we have a full reference to this highest group. And then you see this cross-reference here, there, the divine flames, the here they're called the lions of life, fiery lions, etc. But they're related to this upper Sephirothal triad that we were just looking at here, right? Yeah. So that's that group up in that highest hierarchy. Okay. Let's go back to the passage from the text that we are currently studying, shown here. Oops, what did I do here? Yeah. Sorry, hang on a sec, I gotta get my ducks in a row here. Okay, sorry. Got ahead of myself. Finally, if one studies the comments attentively, you will find the same progression in the angelic natures, viz. From the passive down to the active, the last of these beings being as near to the ahamkara element, the region or plane wherein egoship or the feeling of I am-ness is beginning to be defined, as the first ones are near to the undifferentiated essence. The former are arupa, incorporeal, the latter rupa, corporeal. So here's the first paragraph of the cited commentary on stanza 7, which describes the 12 hierarchies as given by DK. Could we get a reader for this, please?
Yes. Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The hierarchy of the creative powers is divided into 7, or 4 and 3, esoteric, within the 12 great orders, recorded in the 12 signs of the zodiac, the 7 of the manifesting scale being connected, moreover, with the 7 planets. All this is subdivided into numberless groups of divine, spiritual, semi-spiritual, and ethereal beings.
So this is, you know, first generation theosophy attempt to describe this entire hierarchy of creative powers that DK delineates further in his writings. So let's go back to the passage from the text that we are currently studying, shown here, which also refers, though more generally, to the hierarchies. Here, HPB refers to the, quote, the same progression in the angelic natures, viz. From the passive down to the active. The passive being the arupic dhyanis of the liberated hierarchies, which are the highest 4 highest 4 manifested hierarchies, and the active being the lowest 3 hierarchies. Okay, next up. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes, Peggy, can you read that for us, please?
In volume 2 of Isis, page 183. The philosophical systems of the agnostics and the primitive Jewish Christians, the Nazarenes, and the Ebonites are fully considered. They show the views held in those days outside the circle of Mosaic Jews about Jehovah. He was identified by all the Gnostics with the evil rather than with the good principle. For them, he was Aedabus, the son of darkness, whose mother Sophia Achamoth was the daughter of Sophia, the divine wisdom, the female Holy Ghost of the early Christians. Akasha, while Sophia Achamoth personified the lower astral light or ether. Ilda Baoth.
That's Ilda Baoth. Ilda Baoth.
Baoth of Jehovah. Jehovah is simply one of the
Elohim.
Elohim, the seven creative spirits, and one of the lower Sephiroth.
Actually, hold off on reading this paragraph. Just go down to this footnote on Ilda Baoth.
Ilda Baoth is a compound name made up of Ilda, a child, and Baoth, both from the egg and Baoth, chaos, emptiness, void, or desolation, or the child born in the egg of chaos, like Brahma.
Thank you. Okay, so first, in volume two of Isis, the philosophical systems of the Gnostics and the primitive Jewish Christians, the Nazarenes and the Ebionites are fully considered. So the Ebionites were a Jewish Christian sect similar to the Nazarenes. Both practiced poverty, vegetarianism, and ritual bathing. They differed from the Gnostics in that they considered themselves as fundamentally Jewish. The cited passage from Isis Unveiled is more about the secret teachings of that the disciples received from Christ than about Nazarenes and Ebionites, but it is nonetheless a fascinating read. So let's take a look. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Pamela, can you read that for us, please? Pamela, I don't see her.
Yes.
There we go.
I'm sorry. I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Go ahead.
That the apostles had received a secret doctrine from Jesus and that he himself taught one is evidenced from the following words of Jerome, who confessed it in an unguarded moment. Writing to the bishops, Chromatius and Heliodorus, he complains that a difficult work is enjoined, since this translation has been commanded me by your felicities, which Saint Matthew himself, the apostle and evangelist, did not wish to be openly written, for it had not been secret. For if it had not been secret, he, Matthew, would have added to the evangel that which he gave forth was his. But he made up this book, sealed up in the Hebrew character, which he put forth even in such a way that the book, written in Hebrew letters and by his own hand, might be possessed by men most religious.
Thank you. Next.
He admits himself.
Oh, sorry, could we get a new reader, please?
Okay.
Well, yeah, I was just going to ask that. Okay.
I bet.
Let me go Helios soul voice. Can you? I see you're unmuted, but I don't hear you. Do you have a separate button on your headset or something? We can't.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. He admits himself that the book which he authenticates as being written by the hand of Matthew, a book which, notwithstanding that he translated it twice, was nearly unintelligible to him, for it was arcane or a secret. Nevertheless, Jerome coolly sets down every commentary upon it, except his own, as heretical. More than that, Jerome knew that his original Gospel of Matthew was the expounder of the only true doctrine of Christ, and that it was the work of an evangelist who had been the friend and companion of Jesus. He knew that the two Gospels, the Hebrew in question and the Greek belonging to our present scripture, one was spurious, hence heretical. It was not that of the Nazarenes. And yet, knowing all this, Jerome becomes more zealous than ever in his persecutions of the heretics. Why? Because to accept it was equivalent to reading the death sentence of the established church. The gospel according to the Hebrews was well known to have been the only one accepted for four centuries by the Jewish Christians, the Nazarenes, and the Ebionites. And neither of the latter accepted the divinity of Christ. Isis Unveiled, 182:3.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Interesting stuff, huh? Okay. Next up, they, the Gnostics, Nazarenes and Ebionites, show the views held in those days outside the circle of Mosaic Jews about Jehovah. He was identified by all the Gnostics with the evil rather than with the good principle. For them, he was Ilde Baoth, the son of darkness. The Gnostics equated evil with materiality, not with the mythical hell of the Christians. We get to the heart of the matter in this quote from the proem from the Secret Doctrine. Quote, we are told by the Western mathematicians and some American Kabbalists that in the Kabbalah also, the value of the Jehovah name is that of the diameter of the circle. Add to this the fact that Jehovah is the third Sephiroth, Bina, a feminine word, and you have the key to the mystery. The Gnostic Ilde Baoth represents the same principle. The subtext here is the fact that the same third aspect, quote unquote, Lord of Darkness, is considered as the supreme God among the Christians. And next up, whose mother, Sophia Achamoth, was the daughter of Sophia the Divine Wisdom, the female Holy Ghost of the early Christians, Akasha, while Sophia Achamoth personified the lower astral light or ether. Ilde Baoth or Jehovah is simply one of the Elohim, the seven creative spirits, and one of the lower Sephiroth. So before we get into this, let's take a look at the myth of Ilde Baoth. So the disciple John writes in a gospel revered by the Gnostics that Ilde Baoth was created by Sophia, the lowest entity in the realm of perfection, who tried to produce a likeness of herself without the consent of the Father of Light, or Logos. Yeldabaoth emerged as a lion-headed serpent who was ignorant of his own origin and of the higher realms. He created seven subordinate powers, or archons, and declared himself to be the only God. This is the God of the Old Testament. Sophia, regretting her mistake, called upon the Father of Light to correct the imbalance, who then sent a luminous image of a human being called Adamas to appear in the waters of the lower world. Yaldabaoth and his archons saw the image and were amazed by its beauty and intelligence. They decided to create a copy of it using the elements of the material world. Thus, they created the first human being, Adam, and gave him a body of clay and a soul of light. However, they could not give him the spirit of life, which could only come from the Manasa Putras. So we see in this myth another way to describe the lunar lords who projected themselves into dense matter in order to create humanity's physical form in the early root races of our globe. HPV tells us that the highest female aspect is Sophia, the divine wisdom, which she identifies with Akasha, whereas the mother of Yaldabaoth was Sophia Akamoth, who personified the lower astral light. Yaldabaoth is, quote, one of the lower Sephiroth, all of which are emanations of from Bina, the third feminine Sephiroth. The footnote states Yaldabaoth, Yaldabaoth is a compound name made up of Ilda, the child, and Baoth, both from a Hebrew word, the egg, and Baoth, chaos, emptiness, void, or desolation, meaning altogether the child born in the egg of cows of chaos, like Brahma. So now let's take a look at the footnote for Akasha. Could we get a reader, please?
I'm sure. Marianne has her hand up, so let me ask her to say her question and then please read that passage.
Oh, all right then. Just if you could just mention about the Elohim. These are the gods that manage the arm of our solar system. I'm not sure, but I this is such a breathtaking these passages. I'm not really sure I can follow, but if you could just clarify.
First of all, I'm glad that it's breathtaking to you. That's terrific. That's why we're doing this, to be moved by this this information. So the Hindu equivalent are the Prajapatis, which are the seven that emanate from the one. In the Hindu case, it's Brahma. In the case of the Elohim, it's God, right? It's less defined because in the Christian, we don't have the three aspects of God as three gods. So you have that. But it's essentially the same principle, which is they're animated by the seven ray energies of the seven arupic force that then is responsible for all creation. They're great beings who then motivate the Mahadevas and the Deva kingdom to create. Okay, and
all right. More or less. Okay. All right. So you want me to read these series of footnotes? They are found. That's it.
Just what's in dark. Yeah.
Oh, they are found, however, in the Chaldean Book of Numbers.
Now start here, Akasha. The astral light stands in the same relation.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. The astral light stands in the same relation to Akasha and Anima Mundi as Satan stands to the deity. They are one and the same thing, seen from two aspects, the spiritual and the psychic, the super ethereal or connecting link between matter and pure spirit, and the physical. See for the difference between nous, the higher divine wisdom, and psyche, the lower and terrestrial. St. James, the third volume, 15 to 7. Vide demon est duis inversus, part two of this volume.
Okay, so first up. The astral light stands in the same relation to the Akasha and Anima Mundi as Satan stands to the deity. Quite a comment. Remember that HPB equates Satan with the arupic or formless dhyanis who create the higher principles for humanity. Therefore, we have deity or pure spirit and the arupic dhyanas or higher and lower aspect of the spirit principles being compared to the Akasha and the astral light, the higher and lower aspects of the feminine material or principle. So you have two pairs, two dualities being compared here. Next, they are one and the same thing seen from two aspects, the spiritual and the psychic, the super ethereal or connecting link between matter and pure spirit and the physical. So Akasha is the super ethereal and provides the life environment for the arupic beings of which Satan, according to HPB, is chief. The term psychic in HPB theosophy and Platonic philosophy indicates the lower or carnally influenced aspect of the mind or soul, what DK calls the imprisoned soul, as contrasted with the higher or spiritually influenced aspect, kama manas as opposed to buddhi manas. Here are the terms HPB uses in these two sentences, arranged hierarchically with the left column representing the level of consciousness and the right column the plane on which each of these levels manifests. So, you know, you can kind of piece together the these two sentences with the help of this chart more easily. So she's saying that the astral light here stands in the same relation to Akasha and Anima Mundi, which are one and the same, as Satan stands to deity. But see, they're not exactly parallel. They're one and the same thing seen from two aspects, the spiritual and the psychic. So again, you have, here's the spiritual plane and the psychic, the psyche is the state of being would be the lowest here. The psychic would be equivalent to the astral light. The super ethereal or connecting link between matter and pure spirit and the physical. Okay, thoughts or questions?
Greg says lower psychism is higher spiritual psychism on the human monadic expression, perhaps in the monastic or mental plane or vehicle?
Let me read this, Jack. Oh, versus lower psychism versus higher spiritual psychism. Okay, let's see. Yeah, all I can say about that is that you have this division of lower and higher psychism in the monastic plane itself, with the higher mental making possible higher psychism, and lower psychism as a function of kama manas, which is lower mind and astral levels. Okay. Yeah, Scott.
I'm not sure I understand this table you've made. It seems like if you put psyche at the top of its column, that would line up better with the description. Is that true?
You mean put psyche as it's here written at the top of this column?
No, where deity is.
Oh, where deity is.
Just lay them down, the order.
Well, the order is an order of spiritual hierarchy. So what you would have then is what? Go ahead.
So deity and Saturn and Satan line up the way Akasha and astral light do according to the text, but not according to your diagram.
No, I know. Yeah, they're akin, but they're not at the same level. You know, for instance, Akasha, which is, you know, according to DK theosophy, is monadic. Is a monadic plane reality. If you look at deity as being monadic, then you could put Akasha here, but then where do you put spiritual?
being in plane, you added.
Yeah, it's just trying to define the terms, right?
I don't know.
Okay, so we can just talk about these individually. For instance, just starting is, what is the relation between Satan and deity? I mean, you really have to define these relationships in order to commit them effectively in chart form. And as she describes Satan, you have it as this arupic form, which is nonetheless not at the level of pure deity. Because, because the comparison is the lesser to the greater in both cases, right? The astral light stands in relation to Akasha,
right,
as Satan stands to deity.
Which is a source of?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. You know, I mean, if we just had these two next to these two, it would make the whole thing simpler. in terms of just that simple relationship, right? They are one and the same thing seen from two aspects. And I see that as form or plane and essence or indwelling spirit, their beingness, you know. So you have deity and Satan in relation to Akasha and astral light. And the two aspects would be the form or spirit aspect, right?
Well, spiritual. And,
go ahead.
I think what bothers me here is that the being in plane does not come from that paragraph, whereas the psyche and spiritual does.
Okay, so if we did, let's see, so if we just kept it purely logical, then the spiritual
be
here. We can, and the psyche
would be where plane is.
Would be here. And we'll take these out. Oops, better not do it that way. Ah. Okay, maybe I can just do it this way. Hang on a sec. Okay, so if we put Akasha here and then move the light up here, I'll just type it in. It's easier, it seems. So, that make more sense?
That corresponds more to the paragraph, does it not?
Yeah, and then we have to understand Akasha and astral light, and you know, she does this before too. She, you know, this is like the difference between monad and soul kind of a thing, you know, the pure spirit aspect and the psychic, okay. The psychic aspect. But you know, is Akasha and the astral light really a function of psyche?
Well, it doesn't say psyche, it says psychic.
Okay.
It takes it out specific to a general.
And then she brings it all together with the super ethereal, which is going to be like Akasha, or connecting link between matter and pure spirit. It's difficult for me to understand just right. What she's getting at here. I'm not sure. Anyway, we better move on. Thanks, Scott. I think this is more correct based on this. I was doing a pure hierarchical chart before.
A little foggy, but that's all right. Let's move on.
Greg says, I think astral light is a function of the form made manifest, like Vohat converted to form energy.
Astral light is generally considered to be the lower levels of the Akasha, very much connected with, but not confined to, the astral plane. Described in one place by HPB, those levels which are tainted by the personality aspect of humankind, which is of course this mental, astral, and physical planes, and their relationship. I think by the time you get into Buddhic levels, you're in fact even higher mental levels, that you have moved out of what she calls the astral light, but it's never clearly defined in the way that DK defines it. Okay, let's see where we are here. And finally, see the difference between nous, the higher divine wisdom, and psyche, the lower and terrestrial. Vid demon est deus in versus. And part two of this volume. Nous is a Greek term for the highest form of reason, which allows one to grasp the eternal and unchanging principles of reality. It is the part of the human soul that is immortal and divine, and can be aligned with the cosmic nous, or the mind of God. Could we get a reader? This is, and this quote from St. James is given here. Could we get a reader, please?
This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exists, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy.
So you see this distinction, the Kama monastic and the Buddha monastic, really, ultimately. Okay, I went 10 minutes over because we started 10 minutes late. And so, you know, we get a full webinar in. So that'll do it for today. Next webinar is this Friday. It's going to be the Treatise on Cosmic Fire. And you want to do further announcements beyond that? BL.
Yes, the next Secret Doctrine is going to be on the 21st of April at 7 p.m. GMT. And prior to that, the next Secret Teaching of All Ages will be on 7 April at 7 p.m. GMT. So we hope to see you all there.
Thank you all. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.